Okay, yes, I know my internet security is expiring in a few days, and I have renewed it, so do not fret. Okay. All right. It's a privilege to be here with you this morning in this romp through church history, which I suspect will be a little bit more like an ungainly sprint, to be perfectly honest. Just a couple of words of introduction. You don't need to know much about me, but just very briefly, I had a background in an offshoot of Mormonism. I was a fifth generation in that, and it was actually study of church history that got me out of that. So that's one reason why I have a strong affection in this area. And I became a Christian on a trip to Israel in 1981. And it's quite daunting to follow the three blind men and the elephant story, I have to admit. So my only justification is to say that I've been dancing around this particular elephant of church history for quite some time now. So hopefully I've bumped into more than one bit of it. So when you start talking about church history to people, and I have to admit, we often spend a whole semester on this. That's something like 39 class hours. So you're going to get this in about 25 minutes. So this, I have to, you know, put the caveat out here at the beginning. This is going to be an exercise in superficiality. Okay, so as long as you come into this knowing that, hopefully we'll get something out of it. One thing people actually ask, why bother studying church history? Here's one really quick answer. Most of you have seen the movie Bourne Identity. The guy loses his memory. Okay, everyone, I've actually had amnesia. Most people think of amnesia as losing your memory, and obviously it's that. But if you lose your memory, if you lose your past, my argument is you also lose your present identity. Because if you don't know who you've been, you don't know who you are. And if you've lost both of those, then planning for the future becomes often an exercise in futility. That works at an individual level. My argument is it also works at a corporate level where church history is concerned. To the degree that we're ignorant of our past, we don't know our present identity. All churches are interested in their future and where they're going, their plans, their goals, etc. But often a greater knowledge of the past is essential. For us to really know who we are and plan that future. There's my little bit of an apology for looking at this in the first place, for those of you who may have some reservations already, and let's start romping through. Just very quickly, these are the first, these four divisions of church history. We're only looking at the first of these this morning. If you decide that I'm palatable enough and you want me back, we may come back and look at the other three. So these four divisions are not really just random divisions, and they're not really just divisions that apply to church history either. They really apply to history in a wider phase. And as will become clear, hopefully, as we go through, these actually represent significant changes in worldview. So in other words, once we turn the cusp from the early church period around 500-600 AD into the medieval church period, there's a change of worldview and so on right through. And worldview, as most of you would probably know, really sort of sits at a deeper level underneath the level of faith commitment and conscious doctrinal commitment that might actually be there. And we'll find as we go through that, and some of you might be surprised by the latter date, by the way. I often say to students, when do you think modern church history starts? They take one look at me and they think they'll be really polite and say 1950. and they think that's really stretching it. In fact, the way we think as moderns / postmoderns really starts in the 17th century, but that's for another day. Whatever period of church history you're in, people tend to ask a couple of questions. Oh, there you go. There's something else in there. All right. One of those is this question. What is the church? They may not ask it in exactly those terms, but nonetheless they are asking it, and very closely linked with that is this one. Where is the authority? Who is the authority? What's the locus of authority? Now, we're going to jump in our story. We're not going to go through the New Testament period. Normally we start church history really around about 100 AD, which is not to say the church doesn't exist before that. Of course it does. But New Testament studies really cover the story up to that period. Outside the New Testament, there are really no extant writings of Christians that have survived for the period of, say, 70 to 100 AD. So those three decades are often referred to as silent decades. Once we hit 100 AD, we've got a lot of writings that have survived to us from Christian leaders. And we start to see picking up that picture that there are changing demographics of the church. As it moves, it becomes increasingly Gentile in its composition. Jerusalem ceases to become the centre of the church. This is particularly the case after, many of you would know, big cataclysmic event of the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Is certainly one contribution towards that. But other centres such as Ephesus and Antioch and Alexandria, etc., become centres of the church. I will eventually shut up and give you a chance to ask questions, by the way. And in that changing demographic, obviously the church encounters an increasingly wide variety of languages and cultures that challenge it in various ways and pose the question, how effectively will Christianity adapt to this very changing environment? One of the things people know, if people know anything about the medieval period, they tend to know about the Crusades. If people know anything about the early church period, they tend to know that there was a period of persecution and martyrdom. Now, this period of persecution really lasts it begins under a guy called Nero. I'll put a picture of him up in a minute. Yes, he does have a fairly cruel face, by the way. This starts in the mid-60s. It's one of the reasons why we tend to often date the Book of Acts no later than the mid-60s, because the Book of Acts doesn't mention the death of Peter and Paul, for example. And Peter and Paul are both understood to have been martyred under this Neronian persecution. So that perhaps helps us date that particular book. And a period of persecution that lasts about 250 years is instigated with that Neronian persecution. It's not a relentless persecution. It's in about 10 separate periods, and geographically it changes. Not all of these were empire-wide. Some of them were quite restricted geographically. And between those, there were, of course, peaceful periods. Okay, this is Nero. If you want to boo, you can. Now, one of the questions is, well, why martyrdom? Why were people keen on killing Christians? Initially, they were seen as just, as you'd know, a subset of Judaism. And the Roman Empire was generally quite lenient when it took over an area. If there'd been a traditional religion in place, they'd give it the status of religio licita, licit, legal religion. And Christianity benefited from that initially. But later on, when distinctions between Christianity and Judaism became apparent, it moved out of this licit into an illicit category. Nero, and again, many of you would be familiar with the story there in brief terms, made Christians a scapegoat in that first persecution. But there were many misconceptions about Christians. Now, I'd like you for a moment to just imagine you're a Christian in, let's say, the late 1st or early 2nd century AD. What do you think, rhetorical question coming up, what do you think your non-Christian neighbours thought of you? How do you think they thought about you? What were Christian characteristics as perceived by non-Christians? Well, this may surprise you. You were cannibals. Okay? Why? Well, because of what we've just done. Eating the body, drinking the blood. You know? That sort of real vampire, cannibal sort of stuff there. We're incestuous and immoral. May surprise you. But we call each other brother and sister. We talk about loving everybody. We have these love feast things. So they put the worst possible connotation on that and imagine us, you know, having orgies with people to whom we are closely related. We're also antisocial. Why? Well, we're not terribly keen on gladiatorial combat, for a start. Particularly not if we're in the middle of it. If you are a tradesman, you may not be particularly keen, if you're a silversmith, let's say, on making a statue, taking a commission of a statue to a pagan god. Okay. Also, when we gather for a meal, we may often say grace at the start of that meal. Pagans, if you went to the house of a pagan for a meal, they would often dedicate that evening to a particular deity that they worshipped. So Christians were uncomfortable with all of these things, and therefore we're seen as quite antisocial. We're also seen as anti-Rome. Big story behind this, but basically we've got a sort of, and we've got an issue of gender confusion here. But there's a goddess called Roma who's seen as personified in the Roman emperors, who were inevitably male. Failure to worship, in various cases, particularly when circumstances were bad, failure to pay worship to Roma through the person of the Roman emperor was seen as virtually a treasonous thing to do. So the worst things were for Rome, whether that was in terms of barbarians at the borders. And you've all seen the opening scenes of Gladiator, so you all know, you know, about barbarians at the borders. Or whether it was natural disasters. That was the time you were supposed to worship Roma in the person of the Roman emperor. Christians tended not to want to do that, so we're anti-Rome. We're also atheists, which may surprise you or may not, because we tended to worship this invisible God, not a real God that you could see in terms of a statue. But to confuse things, we also insisted on worshipping this carpenter guy from Galilee, and that confused people no end. And I think I've just mentioned we're also seen as being blamed for natural disasters. So whatever something went wrong, we were to blame, because we were not doing the right things, not worshipping the right people. Okay, very early on, we start to see a couple of competing church models. Now, hate to dispel any illusions that some of you may have, but it's very difficult to find any time in church history, any golden age, where you've got a lot of agreement about anything. So some people look at that. You only have to look at the pages of the New Testament to see that's not really the case there, and sad to say, it's not really the case immediately after either. So very early on, we see in contemporary documents a couple of competing models. One of these is a model that's centred on the bishop. Conformity to the bishop is seen as the thing to do at all costs. And we'll see in a minute why there's some feeding into that particular model. A guy called Ignatius particularly puts that idea forward. If you're not in conformity with the bishop, if you're not in fellowship with the bishop, basically the message is you're not in the church. Okay. The contrasting model, which eventually gets eclipsed, is more of a congregation-centred model. And there's a document called the Didache, very short document, but quite a fascinating one. It talks a lot about travelling ministries and how to respond to those ministries, how to discern genuine from false. A lot of rules in there and guidelines about discernment in that area. And also, very interestingly, it talks about the people choosing the bishop. Now, at this stage, the word bishop is more akin to our understanding of pastor. It's more akin to someone who has an authority in a local congregation, rather than if our understanding, which would be quite expected, is dominated by, say, the Roman Catholic or the Anglican understanding of bishops, which is someone who rules over a diocese which contains a number of different congregations. That understanding isn't really there this early on. I'm quite surprised how fast I can talk, actually. At some point, I'll start tripping over my tongue and, you know, it'll go wrong. All right, so those models are in tension for a number of decades. As time goes by, old TV series, I think, as well, a couple of things happen that change the perception of the church. Jesus obviously doesn't come back immediately. And so that changes the tone. When there was this expectation that Jesus was going to come back Wednesday week, then what people tended to do was to try to learn how to leave together. You know, we're a group of people who are going to leave, rather than a group of people who have to learn to live together long term. Deacons and deaconesses, obviously the deaconesses more ministering to the women, assist the bishop in various roles. Early on, the terms bishop and elder are really interchangeable. Later on, the term bishop becomes more senior. And also, the term bishop starts to become pretty much equivalent with apostle and prophet. So rather than having, as, say, seen in the Didache, an acceptance of people who just travel through sort of charismatically gifted by God with certain ministries, and we're open to accept them with a bit of discernment. Gradually, those sorts of gifts and ministries are seen as concentrating on the person of the bishop. Okay, here's an equation. I usually spend a bit of time on this in class. but we don't have a lot of time today. So I usually put this equation up and ask people if they agree with it. Does unity equal unanimity and uniformity? And everybody who's born after 1650, particularly after 1950, thinks about this and says, no, I don't actually agree with this. In the early church, they would have agreed with this. They did agree with this. So if you did anything that was not unanimous, so everyone has to agree with the bishop. If everyone doesn't agree with the bishop, unity is dead. You know? And everyone has to do things the same. Otherwise, it's a major problem. We've already agreed that you disagree. Whether you do or not, well, you can tackle me later. And this is one of the, as we've got one of the big differences between all of the other periods of church history and our own, which that'll become clear a little bit later on. We are able to somehow conceive that unity can exist without those two things on the right-hand side of the equation. And it's worth, you know, this afternoon when you're, you know, having a bit of a quiet time, think about the mental processes that you go through, that we all go through, that we can actually accommodate that. Because I think we all do accommodate that, but they didn't back then. And this is a key part of the difference between worldviews that underlines some of those different four different periods of church history. Okay, so by early in the second century, church is expanding rapidly, it's increasingly Gentile, it's focused on urban centres, and it's in transition from more of an acceptance of a charismatic style of ministry by people who may or may not be ordained formally to this focus on episcopal leadership by bishops. And for reasons that will become obvious, it soon becomes focused very much on issues of order and unity, which is one of the things that feeds into the rise of the bishop. Okay, something called Gnosticism. Okay, the word knowledge is buried in there. You'd recognize, if you put an A on the front of it, you have a word that we'd recognize, agnosticism. Okay, Gnosticism was quite a specific idea with many different varieties. Some common ground. They were dualists, a very sharp division between matter and spirit. Spirit was good, matter was evil. Therefore, God could have nothing to do with matter, which meant, of course, he couldn't have created the world. Which leaves us with a slight question. How did it all get here if God didn't do it? Well, I'm glad you asked the question. The answer to that, one of the common answers, and there's a few, but they're broadly similar, is that the Most High God, who is all spirit and would never be stupid enough to have anything to do with us, really, creates another being. Now, we're going to posit a number of layers of beings who it might be easy to think of as angels, okay? Creates an angel who is a little bit more stupid and a little bit less powerful than he is. Okay, and that angel still has creative powers. That angel creates another being who is a little bit less creative and a little bit more stupid than he is. Now, in one system, there's 365 of these levels. Right? When you get to the bottom level, level number 365, you get a being who is powerful enough to create the world and stupid enough to do so. And that is the God of the Old Testament. Needless to say, this isn't something that's going to receive a great deal of acclamation from Jews, or from Christians, really, for that matter, except it did. And this sort of thinking started to infiltrate the churches. So this was their way of preserving the sanctity, if you like, of this Most High God. Many layers of intermediate beings. Now, like most serious deviations from Christianity. It's fascinating, whenever you see something that you think is really off in terms of its theology, try to find what's right with it. Because usually they've got something really, really right. But it's what they do with that is the question. So here, I think our Gnostic friends had really, really right that there's something wrong with the world. They clearly got that. Okay, but it's what they did to explain what was wrong with the world that is really the point of departure. So for Gnosticism, really, salvation was a knowledge of this system, that this is how things work. And sometimes that led to elitism and various other manifestations. But key thing is, this sort of thinking came into the church and affected how people thought. And you can argue in various ways that it continued for many centuries to have an influence on Christian theology. Okay, a chap called Marcion, who was influenced by Gnosticism. Marcion, sarcastically, you could say, invented the first pocket Bible. You'll see why. So because he was influenced by Gnosticism, he rejected the entire Old Testament. Well, we've already got a smallish book now. This was because he thought the Old Testament God was a God of wrath and judgment, and the New Testament God was a God of love and mercy. And he also thought the Old Testament God was rather racially prejudiced because he, favoured the Jews. Okay. Then when he looked at the New Testament, he decided, there's a bit of favouritism of the Jews going on there also. So he got rid of, fair bit of it, really. And he kept a bit of Luke, didn't like the infancy narratives in there, and kept a bit of Paul. But it's quite easy to carry around in your pocket now, as you can see. Now, the key thing here is here's this guy in the middle of the second century. Important point to make here is that the 27 books of the New Testament were not yet universally agreed. So that doesn't happen until significantly later. So it's quite easy for people to come along and make various challenges. The church had to respond to this. In doing so, they reaffirmed the Old Testament, and they started to come to a really profound place where they realised that Marcion had missed something. Yeah, we can all read the Old Testament and New Testament and see that there are differences there. Okay, but is it so radical as to say, well, the Old Testament's got one God and the New Testament's got another God? The church said, no, we don't agree with that. And in fact, the tensions and the disparities that we see between the two testaments, in fact, point us to the cross. Okay, where justice and love and grace meet. All right. Marcion presented one challenge to the church, its authority, and the developing canon of Scripture. A guy called Montanus presents us with another one a little bit later on. Okay, greater holiness, separation from the world, no problem. Everyone was happy with that. Christ's imminent coming, no problem. Travel with two prophetesses, But when he said, okay, there are three ages, the age of the Father, the age of the Son, and the age of the Spirit. The age of the Father, that's done. The age of the Son is now done. We're now in the age of the Spirit. And really, charismatic utterances are more important than the written word of Scripture, and you should pay particular attention to mine. The church once again had to respond. A different challenge to the authority of Scripture, which of course was still developing, coming from a completely different direction now, but the church is starting to answer, forced to answer by these people, this question, where is the authority? And from this point onwards, we start to see written lists of New Testament scriptures. There are still candidates on there that we don't have today, and there are still some books that we do have today that were seen as being, not entirely certain. But people are seeing the need for this particular an agreement in this particular area. Okay, so all of that, people like Marcion, Montanus, the Gnostics, feed into the development of the rise of bishops and episcopacy. Bishops become unchallenged leaders in church affairs by the end of the second century because people needed to know an answer. When someone comes up next week with another idea, how do we know what's right? We can't just look at our 27 books of the New Testament because we don't quite have full agreement on them yet. So we start looking to the bishops. Heresy contributed towards that. Bishops move into the role of starting to be able to forgive sins. And monarchical bishops, the idea that bishops rule over all other roles was starting to be there. And also we get a very important idea coming through apostolic authority, the idea that the bishops were the inheritors of the authority of the apostles. And we start getting the pass the parcel idea. Who laid hands on whom, and da 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 da. and we trace it back. So the idea was, even in the second century, they were starting to say, well, the people who are in authority in the church now, they were laid hands on and ordained by so-and-so, and it's like tracing your family tree back. Okay, and that is seen as the links to apostles, which of course is a big reason why they chose the New Testament books that they did anyway, is seen as a key thing in authority. Okay, Cyprian comes on the scene, one of these persecutions, persecution under an emperor called Decius. You'll see his face in a minute. He doesn't look very nice either. And they had to deal with the problem of the lapse. What do you do when people deny the faith under persecution and under varying degrees of persecution? You know, someone might deny the faith under all sorts of torture. Another person, you might show them a pair of toenail clippers and they deny the faith. You know, and what happens when the persecution ends and these survivors and their families come back into church together the first Sunday morning? Intense pastoral problem. And Cyprian was one who wrote into this. One of his treatises is on the lapsed. Another is on the unity of the church. And he conceives of, uses some very powerful images. The church is the ark. If anyone had survived outside, did anyone survive outside of Noah's ark? Well, fish, I guess. But if you weren't in the ark, you were cactus. And so therefore, if you're not in the church, similarly. Right? In other words, famous saying, if you don't have the church as your mother, you don't have the God as your father. Okay. So what is the church? Well, the church is increasingly the place that is defined by agreeing with the bishop, and the church is the place where salvation is, and if you're outside of it, which means disagreeing with the bishop, you, increasingly the view is you don't have salvation. Also linked with this is the idea of response to sin, response to those various degrees of lapsing under persecution is seen as the bishop's role. The bishop is the one who determines when someone should come back and when they shouldn't, this sort of pastoral role. And discipline role, and the idea of penance gets a lot of grounding in here. Cyprian's idea, though, at this early stage, was that all bishops are equal. So the idea of the Bishop of Rome in the office of Pope having authority over all bishops is not yet there. By the way, if anyone's head explodes, I know that I've tried to cram too much in, and I'll take that as a warning for next time if I'm invited back. So the bishops are effectively seen as controlling God's grace. Here's a picture, just to give you a break from words. Cyprian, the nice sort of hippie guy on the left with the blonde beard, and well, you can tell. I mean, not very nice chap on the right, the one who is responsible for the persecution. All right, one of the great ironies. A few slides left. Great ironies of history. My supervisor used to say I use the word irony too much in my work. But I think there is God's sense of humour is deeply ironic, and I think one of the other benefits of studying church history is, you know, because God tends to live for an awful long time, so the jokes have a very long punchline. And if you don't study church history, you don't get to see the full joke. Okay, so here's the thing: Christianity starts off persecuted minority sect. No one would have betted on it, would they? Really, let's face it, that it would survive. What odds would you have given that Christianity would outlive the Roman Empire when Jesus was alive or just after? You would have been a very rich person. Of course, you would have had to live about 400 years, but anyway. But that would have been a very much an outside bet. What happens, of course, as many of you would know, an emperor called Constantine converts to Christianity. And in one sense, at that point, Christianity wins over the empire. Persecution ceases, Christianity gets toleration. A few decades later, under another emperor called Theodosius, Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. That is, in many ways, is brilliant news. Okay, no more persecution. The state starts to sponsor Christian activities, but there were some disadvantages. Okay, now a few of you I know have kids. I'm about to show you a photograph of the Emperor Constantine, who I think looks remarkably like Buzz Lightyear. Yeah, a few nods. Okay, all right. Now, what some of the disadvantages? Is the church-state relationship really begins at this particular point. And this is a factor that is dominant in church history for the next 1,500 years at least. For the first time, there's an alliance between the church and the rich and powerful. This is happening early in the 4th century. Okay, first time. Which this means that there is a risk of nominalism, that people will be Christians in name only. Because it could, let's face it, it could now lead to material gain to be a Christian. and it opens the door for something that is a constant theme from here on in, which is the interference, both possible and actual, of the state in church affairs.
And vice versa.
And vice versa, absolutely. If we we do the Middle Ages together, we'll talk about something called the interdict, one of the Pope's most powerful weapons. Okay, but I'll keep you hanging on that one. All right, these are some things Constantine did. Theoretically, equal rights for all religions. It's a bit of a smokescreen, because in fact it's only a really short time between when Christianity ceases to be persecuted and when Christianity becomes persecutors, ors, whatever. Okay, Sunday's a public holiday, he gets wider control, builds Constantinople, which becomes the eastern capital and the eastern centre of Christianity, and starts the Council of Nicaea. There's four big church councils in these early years, and they are the places where Christianity starts to thrash out its core doctrine. When persecution ceases, you've got the chance for a bit more theological reflection. So this is the place where they try to figure out, how do we understand Jesus? Is he fully God and fully human, or is he a bit of this and a bit of that, and does the divine dominate over the human, etc.? Before the Council of Nicaea, there was a whole bunch of church fathers we're not going to mention really by name. One group is the Apostolic Church Fathers. They were the really earliest ones who were seen as having some contact with the original apostles. The Anti-Gnostic Church Fathers obviously wrote against those concepts of Gnosticism. And the Apologists, who were really defending Christianity against all those misconceptions we had on the earlier slide, why we're not cannibals, why we're not atheists, etc., etc. There's actually 38 hardback volumes in the latest catalogue at Coorong. If you feel like parting with $495, you can get all 38 hardback volumes, maybe with a discount if you've got access to that, or you can just download them all for free on the internet, which is much more fun. In many of those writings, there's a lot of stuff that today we would look at as unorthodox. Bearing in mind, these people were living and writing in a time before the central doctrines of Christianity had really been thrashed out, and really before the time that the 27 books of the New Testament were decided. Okay, I'm going to whiz through this. I've only got a couple more slides to go. Lunch might be calling some of you. All right, so mentioned that. Councils. Theological reflection starts with the Council of Nicaea. These are sponsored by the state, you know, pay the expenses, bring the bishops over. A really neat way of doing it, which they did in one of the later councils, if you know that a group of bishops from one area will disagree with you, send out the invitations late enough that they won't arrive in time and vote before they get there. Neat trick. In the Council of Nicaea, there was this big argument between two guys, Arius and Athanasius. Is Christ fully God? Now, I've got a slide here. You won't be able to read the Nicene Creed, and we probably are familiar with that anyway, so we'll skip over that so that I'm not abusing your time too much. Third last slide. Okay, so a later council, Constantinople. Okay, if Christ is fully God, what happens to the natures in there? Council of Ephesus continued that a little bit. And the final one in the early church was the Council of Chalcedon. Now, by this time, as you'll see, we're getting towards the end of that early church period that we put up there of 500/600, and I'll talk about the difference between the two just as we close. But by this stage, some of those early doctrines had pretty much been thrashed out, and a lot of later theology is based on that. The last of those two, Ephesus and Chalcedon, had finally the benefit of the 27 books being agreed on that formed the New Testament. The earliest list we've got dates to a letter of Athanasius is about 367. Very late in the 4th century, that was confirmed. Interesting last point. All of these councils demonstrate the falseness, really, of that equation we put up earlier, because there's really no unanimity amongst anybody at any of these particular councils. All right. Now, we said in one way the irony was that Christianity defeated Rome when Rome accepted Christianity, but now Rome actually falls and Christianity, in one way, takes its place. So the church, before Rome falls, the church has had some significant benefits there. Interestingly, the church was already heading in a hierarchical direction, I think. And as we move towards the end of this early church period, that's locked in even more so. You've got the big example there of the empire itself at a secular level, obviously with the emperor at the top. Increasing disagreements amongst the different churches tended to towards the argument, or to give fuel to the argument, that there should be one church that really is seen as the parent church, and that increasingly becomes, for various reasons, becomes Rome. Now, feeding into that is the fall of Rome to the barbarians and the role of the Pope in that. Now, for Roman Catholics, they see Peter as the first Pope. Most Protestant writers would see this guy, Leo I, as really the first Pope, because he steps into more of a statesman-like role, faces down the barbarians, and even though Rome falls, the barbarians had a grudging acceptance of the Roman religion, which they saw as Christianity, because Rome had been so powerful for so long. So they thought, well, Christianity must have something. When Rome falls, barbarians, as you know, they're not particularly interested in some of the niceties of life, like books, you know, and knowledge and administration. Okay, so what happens is, when Rome falls, to the barbarians, the church is not seen by the barbarians as an enemy. The church is seen as something quite powerful, and the church moves into the vacuum that the Roman Empire has left behind. And effectively, as one writer has said, a guy called Southern has said, really the church becomes the cement, the mortar, that holds Western society together for the next 1,000 years. All right, last slide coming up, just touching on a couple of theological developments here as we close. Some of you might be interested in the growth of the role of Mary. Very early on, Mary is seen as playing a key role in God's plan of redemption, particularly as the antithesis, the opposite of Eve. Although people weren't really addressing prayer to her until really the 5th century. The idea of Mary's perpetual virginity may be new to some of you. The idea that Mary remained a virgin, certainly for the conception of Jesus, but the birth of Jesus, and never had sex with Joseph. This may lead some of you to think, well, hang on, aren't there brothers mentioned in there? Well, they're always explained as either Joseph's children by a previous relationship or cousins. Okay, so this was an idea that gained some particular traction. A lot of ideas in Roman Catholic theology start very early and get flagged, and then by constant usage and debate, eventually get, often centuries later, get accepted formally as doctrine. We've got the idea of purgatory being taught by the 4th century, and I mentioned that point already. 367, Athanasius's list is really the first time we get the complete 27 books. Some of the books are flagged there, like Hebrews, 1 and 2 Peter, James and 3 John, were books that were debated for a while, and some others, like Shepherd of Hermas, etc., were considered as authoritative by some for some time. That's the end. Okay, so a very, as I said, sort of an ungainly sprint, I think, through about 500 or 600 years. Oh, the 500/600 I said I was going to explain. 500 is a nice convenient date after the fall of Rome. 600, there were a lot of quite solid theological writings taking place for the next 100 years, finishing with a guy called Pope Gregory I, Gregory the Great, around 600 AD. And he's really the last writer in that 38-volume set of early church fathers. Really, there is no comparable set for the Middle Ages as we head into the Dark Ages. So that's it for me. Any questions? How about, why did it take you so long? Okay. The Sisters of Jesus, okay, all right. Left them out of it.
I'd like to thank you for making it so tight. Because for those of us who haven't delved into this really much other than accidentally, it gives us a framework to work on for a long time.
Okay, I'm glad. Good.
One of the things that from my reflections of listening to you talk is just how developmental and progressive the whole thing. There wasn't some magical tick here at all. And we've always known that back by head, it makes me reflect on how much we've deified scripture in modern day, as if it was handed down from God on high as a set of books But in fact, there's a developmental thing that's happened, and it seems to be no one anywhere has said, and this is where that development stops.
Mm.
There's some implications in this revelation.
Sure.
But no one, there's no...
Yep. But I think
we treat it as if it has.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, I think the key thing comes back to that apostolic authority thing. So really the books that got finally accepted were books that were seen as being written by apostles, written by people who were close to apostles, right? And there were other categories. Had they been esteemed and used in Christian churches for some time and helpful in worship, if they couldn't make an apostolic link directly. But once you get beyond the second century, you know, the idea of that Christ is the final word, and therefore clearly the people who had, we historians love sources, love primary sources, so you really want those sources that aren't necessarily as distorted by subsequent layers of interpretation, and clearly that's something that's in the background there. When were these documents written? You know, what access did they have to these original circles around Jesus? The more that gets diluted, but you know, important point in there I think is the fact that this was, let's say, antagonistically collegial. People worked this through, and clearly there were different points of view, and I think this is something that probably resonates with us a bit in modern church communities, as a model for the fact that we have different views, we have disagreements, but there's a value placed in there on working things through as a Christian community. Yes.
I'm rather intrigued with the relationship between the church and the Roman Empire, which I personally regard as rather a disaster.
Mm.
But when was the church first referred to as the Holy Roman Empire?
So the Holy Roman Empire is actually a later development. All right. So the Holy Roman Empire is something that really is a medieval development. So I think you might mean Holy Roman Catholic Church?
No.
No? Holy Roman Empire? Okay. Okay. All right. I can help you out with that one. All right. So the Roman Empire, as we've just seen, falls in the late 5th century. A lot of people in the Middle Ages...
The Western Empire.
Yes.
The Roman Empire actually survives in the 16th
century. Indeed. Indeed. And, you know, one of the things I have to admit, I've got a Western bias here. This is how I've been taught. But one of the things, in the next period, if you invite me back, we'll talk a bit about the Dark Ages. And the Dark Ages were a Western manifestation. You know, you have a very vibrant non-Dark Age culture happening in the East. Okay, you've got the Western speaks Latin, the Eastern speaks Greek. That leads to all sorts of theological misunderstandings. But to come back to your question, once the original Roman Empire falls, there's a lot of looking back with nostalgia by people on, wasn't it great when? You know, so for example, some historians have said, some of you would have heard the term Pax Romana. So, you know, part of that was it was safe to travel throughout the Roman Empire. When Rome falls, of course, that disappears. And one writer has said it was not ever again as safe to travel around Europe until the 19th century. 1400 years. Okay? Big period of time. So people look back on Rome and say, wasn't it great when you could travel without being mugged? You know, things like that. So the Holy Roman Empire is actually a construction from around about 800 AD. So it is much later. It looks back nostalgically to the original Roman Empire. It's around the time of Charlemagne, and it's really a much more limited geographical entity, more like Italy and Germany and France, and not much more than that. So there is a Holy Roman Emperor. He plays a big part in European affairs in many ways. It's finally dismantled under Napoleon I in the early 19th century. So the Holy Roman Empire lasts for about 1,000 years. But it's a much more diluted, although still influential, concept.
It's not the church. It's a political system.
It's very much tied up with the church. And
sure.
Is that also a period of persecution?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you've got the whole situation, say, around Martin Luther, and also around some of the issues to do with the church in England. You know, this persecution around all of that. You know, things like the Inquisition, all of those fall into the middle of that period when the Holy Roman Empire is around.
I get a feeling we could go on for a very long time.
And we better not.
I'd like to thank you, and there's lots of questions I'd like to ask as well, mate.
Okay.
Have you got time?
I'll hang around for a cup of coffee, so it costs me then.
Yeah. Right? Give him a cup of coffee first, so the poor guy.